Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 241, and it's New Year's, and we're going to talk about something very exciting and special for New Year's, and that would be storage units. All right, hear me out. There's something cool here. We're also going to talk about diesel heaters and the trick that can be played upon you when you buy one. A product review of an electric heater because it's that time of year. And a resource recommendation that is an anti-resource recommendation. We will get to that when we get there. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for joining me for the very first episode of 2025. Given that this is the first day of 2025, that's hardly surprising. But I'm happy you're here. However, I have to start with news of personal nature, and I hate doing this every week. It seems like I've been doing this a lot lately, but it matters, so I have to do it. So, first off, there's a sound you might hear in the podcast from time to time. Luke from Finland pointed this out to me a while ago, and he's like, what is that noise? I will try to cut a piece of that noise and play it here. We'll see, but the noise is my chair. I have a 30-year-old Herman Miller Aeron chair that I sit in, and I've been sitting in it for, yes, you're right, 30 years. It's a very, very comfortable chair. It was a very, very expensive chair, and I first bought it in 1997, and I'm not willing to give it up yet. The piston's starting to go, and it does make that crack noise every once in a while, and for some reason, the mic picks it up like it's right next to the mic. All the other noises going around me do not make it to the podcast, but that noise does. So whenever you hear that sound, I apologize. It's my chair. I'm not willing to give it up. But now you know. Now you're on the inside and you can say, "Up, there goes Jeff's chair again." And that makes you cool. Okay, now on a more serious note, folks, I am terribly sorry to announce this, but I will not be attending VanFest Liftoff this February. I just got dates for surgery, and they conflict with it, unfortunately. I'm going to go into surgery at the end of January, and my recovery time is estimated to be at least 6 weeks. I'm not allowed to drive during those 6 weeks, which is going to be a hardship. And that means no VanFest for me. I've already talked to Lance, and, well, I feel bad. I had a lot of stuff planned, and I was really looking forward to meeting some of you guys. Not all of you. Some of you guys. And, yeah, I can't go. I'm sorry. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't go. If you are looking for a great weekend of van life content with exhibitors and workshops and a whole bunch of rigs you can tour and people you can hang out with, please go to VanFestUSA.com and find out about Liftoff, which is their Florida event that they're going to do every kind of midwinter, early spring, depending on how you look at it kind of thing. It's in Melbourne, Florida. It's actually in Vieira, which is near Melbourne. And last year, we saw a rocket liftoff from there, and it was awesome, and I hope that happens again this year. But anyway, it's a great event. I'm very, very sad to be missing it, but I have to get this ankle fixed. It is really messing me up. I have two big trips planned this year, one to Norway and Belgium and Scotland, and another one to the Bermuda Triangle, and I need to lead groups around, and my foot doesn't work, and I got to fix it. So, apologies, and for anybody who might be worried or anything, this is not a major surgery. It's arthroscopic. They're just going to go in and I don't know what they're going to do. I don't want to think about it too much, but they're going to do stuff to my ankle that will make it better in time. So, yeah, I will not be doing any winter camping, it seems, this year, because I think the earliest I can possibly head out on the road is going to be in March or so, and I've got some big plans this year. Not ready to announce them yet, but I can't really commit to anything until I get this ankle fixed. However, that means I'm going to have plenty of time to work on this book, so I have even less of an excuse not to get it done by March. All that said, I thought I'd start out the new year with... There's that noise. I'd start out the new year with a very exciting topic, storage units. And it is actually a little bit more interesting than you might think. So to be clear here, I'm not talking about, you know, little plastic storage bins. That's a whole other topic. And by the way, the Container Store just filed for bankruptcy. They were always very expensive, but they also had things that nobody else had, and they were a good resource for van life. So I don't know if they're going to have a big sale that you might want to take advantage of, or if they're going to keep doors open. I don't know what the story is, but yeah, they have filed for bankruptcy. Anyway, I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about, you know, the big storage units, the one, the ones that you could, you know, empty your house into, and they come in all different sizes. And it's funny, when I married my wife, I found out that her family traditionally always had a storage unit. And I thought that was odd. It was like, well, you've got this, you've got a house, you've got a storage, why don't you? And it turns out this is actually fairly common, is that people will have storage units just to store their excess stuff. And this makes some sense for van life. For example, let's say that you're going to do van life for a while, maybe permanently, maybe just for a few months, whatever your situation is, but you're going to give up your apartment or house or wherever you've been living. And you've got stuff you don't want to give up, but you also don't want to bring it in the van, like maybe a whole bunch of photo albums or your vinyl collection or all your winter clothes, or maybe you have some bicycles and you're only going to bring one. Whatever it is that you have that you want to keep, a storage unit might be the place to put it. But before that, I would like you to consider the following things. First, it's certainly going to be a lot cheaper to find a friend or family member with a basement who will let you put some stuff down there. Now, that can get annoying, and people sometimes get upset because people leave things in their basements too long and all that. You'll have to negotiate that. But that is a better solution than a storage unit, in my opinion. Also, consider the value of the stuff you're storing. Now, stuff with nostalgic value, that's one thing. You know, if you're grandma knitted a whole calendar. Let's say your grandma was very creative and she knit a calendar and it was huge because each month was a quilt. Okay, I'm really taking this out there. So you've got 12 months of quilt. It's huge, but it has so much value in it that you don't want to give it up. Yeah, a storage unit could be great for that. You're certainly not going to be able to fit it all in the van. But if you don't have stuff like that, if you just have stuff like furniture or lamps or, you know, old tools, whatever, how much is that stuff worth? Because at some level, we're just talking about money. This is just about money. And so you might think, oh, I've got $800 or $900 worth of tools. I better find a place to store it. Now, here's a storage unit. It's $100 a month. And well, folks, do the math. If you rent that place by the year, which is what they want you to do, or even by 6 months, you're going to be spending more than the value of what you're storing very, very quickly. So because of that, I am not a big fan of storage units. But I do recognize that they can be a solution for people in certain circumstances, such as somebody with grandma's quilt calendar that I just made up, and a van that can't hold it all. Now, you could get a trailer. This is another option. Instead of getting a storage unit, you buy a trailer, use that as a storage unit, and then pay to park the trailer. In some cases, that could be cheaper. So instead of spending all that money on a storage unit, you get a utility trailer that you can tow with your van, and then you can park it anywhere you want. Like, let's say your first year of van life, you're going to do the Pacific Northwest, you bring your trailer, you park it somewhere up there, and then your second year, you want to explore southeastern U.S., well, you just drag it down there and park it down there at some storage place or a parking place. That is not a bad way to go. Plus, you have this vehicle that is worth some money, and you're paying less per month. So I kind of like that. But for folks who aren't ready to do that, or they have a vehicle they can't tow or whatever, what kind of storage unit should you get? Well, it turns out that storage units are not priced the same all over the country. Storage units on the West Coast and the Northeast are much more expensive than storage units in the middle of the country, which, you know, it seems to be the trend for everything. Where's gas more expensive? Oh, on the West Coast and the Northeast. That's how it is in this country, and that's how it is for storage units, too. So strategically, if you are somebody driving all over the U.S., where should your storage unit be? Well, it should be near an interstate. It should be not near a major city, and preferably it should be where two interstates meet. And I have found two spots that I think you should look at. One is Big Springs, Nebraska. What's in Big Springs, Nebraska? A storage place. Now, Big Springs is right where Interstate 80 and Interstate 76 come apart, okay? So that gives you fairly easy access to Denver. And from Denver, you have access to 70 and 25 and 80s right there. I mean, that's a pretty good hub for getting in interstates all around the country. And it's really inexpensive there. There are good-sized storage units there for like $30 a month, $35 a month. So that's one idea. Another place that's even cheaper is just north of Oklahoma City in a town called Edmond. Edmond, Oklahoma has some very cheap storage. You can rent a 5x5 unit. Now, that's not very big, obviously. 5 feet by 5 feet is not huge, but it's $13 a month, and I'll bet those quilts would fit in there. Or if you need more space, you can go to a 10x10 for $33 a month. That's not bad. And they also allow vehicle storage here, too. Plus, Oklahoma City connects everything to everything. You've got I-35, you've got 240, you've got 40, you've got 44. You can get anywhere from Oklahoma City pretty quickly. I mean, see, that's the trick here. If you're going to have a storage unit, you want it to be somewhere that's fairly easy to get to, regardless of where you are in the country. So being sort of in the center of the country and near interstates is important. So there's two places you could look. Now, if you're living in San Francisco, you're in trouble. Storage units in San Francisco cost a fortune. Same thing with if you're in New York or Boston or Chicago. We had a storage unit here briefly as we downsized from a house into this condo we're living in now, and it was a cost a fortune, and the prices kept going up and up and up, and so finally I just got rid of everything. Remember, storage units are a monthly expense, and all the stuff in the storage unit must be worth more than you're paying for storage, or you're wasting your time and it's silly. Just keep that in mind. But it is an option. Two other things about storage units that are important to remember. You may not live in storage units. I know there are YouTube videos of people living in storage units. In fact, I've had listeners to this podcast who told me they were living in a storage unit. I'm not going to rat you out. If living in a storage unit is your best option, more power to you. But it's more likely than not that it is illegal, and it's almost definitely against the rules. So if you can navigate those things, that's fine with me, but you will be living in a constant state of fear of being found out. But more practically, can you build out a van in a storage unit? Yes, no, that one's going to be unit by unit specific. Now, first off, a lot of them aren't tall enough for you to actually park your van in. That's a whole other thing. But let's say you just had a bunch of tools in there and you parked your van in front and you were like, you know, using the bandsaw or whatever. Well, they typically don't have power. So you're going to have to provide your own source of power, which, you know, if you get a van, that's something you can do. And they typically are not going to be temperature controlled. So you have to be careful about what you're storing in there. It's going to be the same temperatures that your vehicle is going to experience. It's going to be super cold and super hot, depending on where it is. So you have those things to consider too. But if you were building out a van and you were just in the process and you knew this was going to be temporary, you could rent a fairly small storage unit and like store sheets of plywood and things like that in there. And then every day go visit it, grab what you need, go find some place you can work on it, and then go back to that space and unload what you don't need. There are companies that work like this, like plumbers and such, where they will just have a storage unit with all the tools and supplies they need, and rather than have folks drive into an office, which might be downtown, they'll have their workers drive to a storage unit on the outskirts of town, get all the stuff they need, and then they're closer to the folks in the suburbs or whatever. Anyway, I don't have any special coupons for you. I don't have any companies to recommend. I've used a few of them. They've all been fairly fine. Personally, I would rather use a mom and pop kind of storage unit place, but the problem with that is that they could go out of business. Or there could be a death in the family or something, and suddenly you don't know what's going on. Or you might get a phone call, hey, we're closing down, you got to get all your stuff out in a week. That's less likely to happen with a big outfit like Extra Space or U-Haul or somebody like that. Anyway, do your research, figure out exactly what you want. But sometimes storage units can be a good solution for folks trying to live out of vehicles. But man, please don't pay for a storage unit until you've done the math. Thanks to Linus and Kent for helping to sponsor this show. Because of folks like Linus and Kent and everyone else who's donated, especially those folks who donate every month, we don't have any ads. That means you don't have to listen to any ads. I don't have to listen to any ads. I don't have to, like, get upset because they're advertising things I don't approve of, etc., etc., etc. We can just have nice podcast time. So if you would like to make that a reality, or rather keep that a reality, please visit buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And you can buy me some diesel, and that will help keep the show going. By the way, I just got a bill for $300 for a server for this podcast, which is a bit much, but that's what your donations help to pay for. It is not free doing this. I'm not trying to get rich, but it does cost me some money, and I would like a little help. Thank you, guys. Tech Talk. What size diesel heater should you get? Now, we're talking about cheap Chinese diesel heaters here. Not your Webastos, not your Eberspatchers. That's in a whole other league. Webastos and Eberspatchers, Planars, all those cost many, many, many times more than a cheap Chinese diesel heater. There's two philosophies. Buy quality, and you only buy once, or you just keep buying them as they break. But, you know, you can get a cheap Chinese diesel heater for $100, and some of the Eberspatchers are $1,300. That means you could go through 13 cheap Chinese diesel heaters before you reach the same monetary expense of an Eberspatcher, which can also have problems. That's a whole philosophical thing. That's not what I'm talking about here. What I want to talk to you about here is how they lie to you. If you go onto Amazon or wherever you're going to buy your cheap Chinese diesel heater, you're going to see three sizes, the most common, and they're measured in kilowatts, which is just a measure of energy. So you've got the 2 kilowatt ones, which are the smallest ones, the 5 kilowatt ones, which are the by far the most common. That's what almost everybody gets. And the 8 kilowatt ones, which you would think would be bigger, right? And generally, based on what I've seen, and this varies a bit, but the 5-kilowatt ones are also the cheapest. The 2-kilowatt ones are harder to find and sometimes cost more. And they have an advantage if you are using a small vehicle, like an NV200 or a ProMaster City or a minivan or something like that, because you do not want an oversized heater for your rig. And the reason is that if the thing cycles a lot, meaning it reaches its set temperature quickly and then it cools down and does that over and over again, that cycling can help build up soot. So you don't want one that's too big. You want the right size. The two kilowatt ones have an advantage in that they will run longer. They're not going to use any more fuel. They're just going to run longer in a small vehicle, which is good. And the units are physically smaller. The 2 kilowatts are a smaller box, which makes them easier to fit. That's all great. Now, the 5 kilowatts, which is what I have, are fine for most vans. 5 kilowatt works great in my 144 Sprinter. I am nowhere near maxing this thing out, even on the coldest days, so I bet it would do a 170 just fine. But when you get up into the schoolie territory, you know, 5, 7, however many windows your schoolie has, then maybe an 8 kilowatt is appealing. But here's the problem. In many cases, they're all exactly the same thing. And other people have noticed this. Because it's just a label on the box. And when you open the box, there's no label on the heater that says 5 kilowatts, 8 kilowatts, or whatever. And it seems like some of these companies, they're only selling 5 kilowatt units. So you order a 2 kilowatt and you get a 5 kilowatt. And you won't know the difference if you don't compare. Or you order an 8 kilowatt, which does cost more, and you get a 5 kilowatt. And again, it says 8 kilowatt on the box. And then you get this plastic thing and you install it. It puts out heat. You're happy, not realizing that it's exactly the same as the 5 kilowatt one. And this happens all the time. There was a video I just watched. They actually took the units apart. They bought a 5 kilowatt and an 8 kilowatt and took them apart completely. And the only part that was different between the 8 kilowatt and 5 kilowatt was this metal plate that had a different color paint on it. All the components were exactly the same. The combustion chamber was the same. It was the same pump, the same controller. And you might think, oh, well, that doesn't mean it's the same programming for the controller. Maybe the 8 kilowatt has different programming. Nah, these things aren't that complex. The thing basically is just telling the fuel pump how often to cycle. Every one of those ticks is a squirt of fuel, and the fuel pump is basically telling it how many ticks to make. 8 kilowatt, 5 kilowatt, there's no difference there. So what's happening is that the factories are pumping out 5 kilowatt ones. It's more work for them to retool to do an 8 kilowatt or 2 kilowatt, and some of them just aren't doing it. Or they can't get the 2 kilowatt and 8 kilowatt ones, but there's still a market for them, so they just print a sticker and they put it on there, 8 kilowatts. So caveat emptor, folks. If you are looking for a diesel heater that is not a 5 kilowatt, if you're looking for 5 kilowatts, which is most of you, you're fine. Just get whatever you want. But if you're looking for a 2 or an 8, it can be hard. So read the reviews very carefully. Again, the 2 kilowatts are actually a smaller unit. So make sure that the measurements of the 2 kilowatt match what you're ordering, and also make sure that you get what you ordered, because you absolutely can go and buy a 2 kilowatt heater and get a 5 kilowatt in the mail. 8 kilowatt ones, I actually have never seen one of these. I don't know how much bigger they are. They may not be any bigger. I don't know what they're doing that makes them 8 kilowatts versus 5. But one trick, and this is what the guy in the video did, so he bought a 5 and an 8 from the same company. And that way he could compare. And he, you know, the idea is you pick the one you want and you can send it back, right? Amazon, for example, is pretty liberal about sending things back. And when he got them, they were exactly the same thing. So in that case, because the 8 kilowatt was more, he just sent that back. Or he actually may have sent them both back, because that's pretty shady. And I hate to say it, but that was Vivor. He bought a Vivor 5 and a Vivor 8, and they were exactly the same thing. And Vivor is a brand that I kind of like. That's what I have in my van. Now, I don't know that he bought them directly from Vivor. It may have been somebody else selling Vivor stuff. I don't know. Anyway, you get the point. Be careful. What you order may not be what you get. But the good news is that 5 kilowatts is pretty good for almost everybody, unless you have a really small or a really big vehicle. Product review. Back on the subject of heat, those of you who are fortunate to have shore power in the winter, and a lot of RV people do this, including me, use a space heater. Because it's easy. You get a little space heater, you plug it in, and you've got warmth, and you don't have to worry about running out of fuel and everything. Of course, the trick is you need power. These, yes, you can run them off batteries, but they're going to eat your batteries pretty quick, even if you have a lot of batteries. These things use more power than an air conditioner. They suck power, which is, that's what they do. They turn power into heat. That's what you want. But here's the thing. Which one should you buy? They're all over the place. They range in price from $25 to $250. And you know what? They all give off exactly the same amount of heat. It's true. Doesn't matter what they say in their website. Technology Connections, you know, that YouTube channel, it's very famous, Technology Connections with Alex. He did a breakdown of this showing these giant space heaters and these little tiny space heaters, and they all give off the same amount of heat. Why? Because they're all limited to 1,500 watts. They're all 1,500 watts, and watts is power. So the most that any of these things can do is take 1,500 watts of electricity and turn it into heat, and that's all any of them are doing. So you can get a giant tower fan that produces 1,500 watts of heat, or you can get a little tiny one that just fits in your plug that produces 1,500 watts of heat. Yeah. It's true, it's crazy, but that's all there is to it. So if you're looking for a little space heater, don't worry about the heat part. Just worry about the features you want. And this week, I am recommending a very specific one by Amazon Basics, because Amazon Basics has a pretty good standard of quality. And this thing is all you need. It's all you need. I have a link in the show notes, of course. It is the Amazon Basics Ceramic Space Heater. That's it. That's all you have to do. It's not huge, but it's not tiny. It's 7.5 inches in diameter, 6.34 inches wide, and 9.45 inches high. You know, the metric system, anyway, everybody who's not in the U.S. understands exactly what I'm saying. But you can get it in black and white, and they even have an oscillating version for $5 more. But it's just a little heater. You plug it in, it has tip-over protection, which you absolutely want, and it has three modes. It has just fan, which is useful, fan with heat, and then fan with more heat. That's it. It weighs 3 pounds. It's dead simple. 900 watts and 1500 watts are your choice. And actually, that's good. I have one that I use all the time in the Airstream, and its choice is 1300 watts or 1500 watts. Well, 1300 is a lot. 1500 is even more. There's no kind of middle there, and 900 is better. So I like this better. Now, it has a thermostat. When you are the temperature you want it to be, you turn the thermostat until it turns off, and that's right where you want to keep it. My problem with the thermostats on all these things is that they turn the fan off, too. And I can't sleep with that. With the fan turning on and off all night, I can't sleep like that. So, anyway, your mileage might vary. All the normal safety talk about space heaters needs to be included here. You have to be very careful with these things. They are a fire hazard. You don't want to have anything in front of them. And yeah, they've got tip-over protection, whatever. But keep in mind that when it tips over, it may shut off, but it's still going to be pretty hot. So say if it falls over into a box of crumpled up newspapers or something like that, you can still have a fire. So you do have to be careful. But these are pretty safe, pretty basic, and it's $22.49 right now. So heck, if you're looking for a space heater, I would start here. Now, maybe you want one that's a tower that spreads air more evenly, or maybe you want one that doesn't have a fan at all, that's oil-filled. They have all those, too. But just remember, they're all the same amount of heat for the same amount of electricity. There's no difference there. So, I say start cheap. Anyway, it is the Amazon Basics Ceramic Space Heater. Link in the show notes, but you can also find it on your own. Tales from the Road. Back when I was 14, I joined Boy Scouts. I was kind of old to be joining Boy Scouts, but heck, I figured it was fun, and it was. I instantly fell in love with Boy Scouts. I fell in love with camping. I tried to camp all the time. In fact, I camped all summer long most of the years I was in the Boy Scouts, and then at least one weekend a month. Sounds like the National Guard. But I loved it, and I didn't care about the weather. My idea was that you should camp in any weather you want. And I grew up in Massachusetts, so it got cold in the winter, and fortunately, my scoutmaster agreed. And he took us out winter camping, which is pretty gutsy, honestly. I have a lot of respect for him doing that and keeping us safe. And we didn't get a lot of training on it. We were told to bring, you know, really warm sleeping bags, but a lot of it was left for us to just figure out with supervision. You know, we didn't want anyone to die. So we did. You know, I learned about the sleeping bag inside a sleeping bag trick, which is that you basically have two sleeping bags. One's a little smaller than the other, and you put the smaller one inside the big one, and that really provides a lot of insulation. We learned that if you heat rocks up in the fire, you can then put them in a canvas bag, which we happen to have, and then put that in the bottom of your sleeping bag. You have to be careful about this, but we did. And that will keep you warm all night. Nowadays, I'd use a hot water bottle, but it's the same idea. And we were fine. You know, we were down at, it was 10 degrees Fahrenheit, which is like minus 12 degrees Celsius. I mean, it's pretty cold. And we had, you know, we had a learning curve. You know, when we brought food on these camping trips, we didn't buy camping food. We just went to the supermarket and bought normal food. And we were like, oh, we don't have to worry about stuff going bad. So we can get milk. And we get milk with our cereal. And you know, we were smart enough to keep the milk in the tent so the milk didn't freeze. But in the morning when we dumped out our Frosted Flakes and poured the milk on it, at that temperature, the milk almost instantly froze, and we created this new concoction of frozen Frosted Flakes, which wasn't quite as good and certainly wasn't hearty. We also had hot bug juice, which is like Hawaiian Punch or Kool-Aid that you heat up. That was good. It was actually fun. You know, it was cold, but we were prepared for it. And we played and built stuff and did things all day long, and it was great. However, there was one kid. There's always that one kid. There was one kid who brought sausages. And he brought just raw sausages. And he was trying to cook them with Sterno. Now, we had used Sterno for cooking before, and we had these little stoves, and you'd put a Sterno can in there, and you could cook on them. It was a little slower than using the fire, but it was also easier. Now, time out here. This is back in the days when everything was done with fires. You know, I know Boy Scouts has changed a lot, and they don't really cook with fire as much as they used to because of fire hazards, things like that. But back in the 80s, when we were doing this, it was fire, 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 fire. We always had a fire going constantly. So we were cooking on fire, except for kids like this who wanted to cook with Sterno, which was fine. But at that temperature, Sterno was so slow, and he was getting so hungry, and he realized that he was still cooking breakfast while everyone else was finished and kind of going out and doing stuff, that he kind of ate the sausages when they weren't really done. Now, yuck. Sausages are definitely a food that you want to make sure is cooked thoroughly. Anyway, he ate them and, you know, did the best you can with dishes. We learned very quickly that washing dishes in the winter is extremely difficult. And he joined us. And then we were walking around this frozen pond, which was kind of cool because it was so cold and the pond was so frozen that it started to pressure crack. And if you've never walked on a frozen pond, and again, I'm not recommending you do this unless you know what you're doing, they sometimes freeze so much that the ice expands and will crack, and it makes this deep, thunderous noise that you feel in your feet. And, it goes, and the whole pond kind of shakes a little bit, and sometimes you can see the crack form. And it's not dangerous. It's not like the crack's going to form and you're going to fall through the ice. We were walking on ice that was about a foot thick. We were fine. There was no danger there. But it was a lot of fun. And we noticed that this sausage kid, which I'm sadly going to call him now, wasn't around. Like, where did he go? And like, you know, that's kind of a problem. It's winter and you're missing a scout. Now, this is on the adults, all right? I'm not going to blame any of the kids for not keeping track of another kid. The adults have the responsibility of keeping track of the kids. This kid was maybe 13 or so at the time. Still, number one rule is you know where your people are at all times. And so we did a search and we went to his tent. Wasn't in there. Like, where is he? And then finally, someone thought to go look out on the other pond. This campground had two ponds. And there, out in the middle of the pond, laying on the ice, was this kid. Just laying on the ice, kind of in a fetal position. So we're like, what the kid? So the adults took over at this point. They rush out there. They grab the kid. They thought he might be hypothermic. And he went away. I believe they just called his parents and they took him home. I don't think they had to call an ambulance. I don't remember that clearly. It was a long time ago. But he was gone. He left the camp. We never saw him again. No, we saw him again. But he was done camping for that weekend. It turns out that what happened was he cooked the sausages and ate them and realized they weren't quite cooked. And then he started to feel ill and he got sicker and sicker. He was afraid he was going to throw up. He didn't want to throw up in front of everybody. So he just went off. And he was just kind of walking and walking and waiting for it to happen and waiting for it to happen. And finally he found himself out in the middle of the ice and he was like, I'm just going to have a little nap until this passes. And he fell asleep on the ice. 10 degrees. Bad, bad, bad situation. So, moral of the story is, from then on, we only allowed brown and serve sausages because they were already pre-cooked. You can swallow a frozen brown and serve sausage and be fine. No more uncooked sausages were allowed. And we, the adults anyway, I found out later privately, decided to have a little talk amongst themselves about how they were keeping track of kids. And I think one of them actually left the organization after that because that could have turned out pretty badly. So, yes, you can camp in the winter. You can be comfortable. You can have fun. But don't eat raw sausages. And if you're not feeling good, tell somebody. And then go back to your tent or somewhere where people can find you. Don't just wander off into the middle of a frozen pond. That's not good. A place to visit. However, if you really want to visit a frozen pond, or say drive across a frozen pond or a frozen lake, you can do that. There are places in the U.S., and I'm sure Canada, I know Canada, that the lake freezes over. And they can use it as a road. And I have done this. I did this on Lake Champlain in Burlington, Vermont, where the ice had frozen so thick that there was no question it could hold a vehicle. And I actually drove down a boat ramp and drove my truck out on the ice just to see what would happen. And it was fine. I drove around a bit on the ice and I was like, look at me, I'm driving on the ice. Isn't this crazy? And I had studded snow tires on. It was fine. I wasn't racing or anything. I was literally just driving around out there. And then I drove back up the boat ramp and that was it. That was my adventure driving on the ice. But in places where they do ice fishing and things like that, driving on the ice is actually normal. And in some parts of the world, especially Alaska, they actually divert roads over the ice because it's that much shorter. It's an ice bridge, right? And you can do this. One place that is arguably the easiest place to do it, at least it's the one that you can do the most research on, is Voyageurs or Voyageurs National Park in Minnesota. That's V-O-Y-A-G-E-U-R-S, the French spelling, Voyageurs. I'm not saying that right. I apologize. And this is a huge place. 218,000 acres of lakes and forests and streams. But in the winter, yeah, you can drive on the ice. They create this big road, and they will. It's managed. That's the thing. It's managed. They mark off places where you can't drive. They mark off places where you can drive, and you can drive around up there, and it's very cool. There are orange stakes that mark out places you're not supposed to go, which is actually what they use in Antarctica, too. There are diamonds or X's that say, don't go there at all, that's really dangerous. And then there are thin ice signs that, you know, you're driving a vehicle on the ice, probably a good idea to pay attention to the thin ice sign, yeah. And there's more to it than that, too. There are pressure ridges. Remember those cracks I talked about on that pond before? Well, sometimes it's like tectonic plates. The ice cracks, and then the two big pieces of ice come together and form a mountain, and you have to be careful driving over that. People love to go out there, and just like on playas, you know, salt flats. They will just drive as fast as they can. But you don't want to do that on ice because you could encounter one of these ridges and kind of launch your vehicle. Don't do that. Snowmobiling is by far a safer way to do this. So let's be clear here. Snowmobiles are much better at this than cars. But if you're the kind of person that just wants to check, drove on a frozen lake off on your bucket list, this is not a bad place to do it. And yeah, you can do ice fishing here too. You know, if you have your stuff, you could absolutely pull your truck out there, set up a little tent, drill a hole in the ice, and do some ice fishing. Very, very cool. Weird thing about driving on ice, and if you watch like Ice Road Truckers or any of those shows, they talk about this. Ice is not static. The weight of your vehicle on the ice will deform the ice a bit. Basically, it'll press down on the ice and bend it a bit. You may not be able to tell. But as you're driving across the ice, you're pressing the ice down and creating a wave under your vehicle. And when you get to shore, that wave can hit shore and then kind of break up the ice and stuff. And it happens more the faster you're going. Now, a big truck is going to do this more than your car, but some of our vans, folks, are doing 10,000 pounds or so. Yeah, this could be an issue. So make sure you follow the rules. At this place, it's no faster than 30 miles per hour. And you're not allowed to use salt or sand. If you are on a slippery spot and you need some more traction, no salt or sand, because salt and sand will actually help the ice melt faster, and that's not something you want if you're driving on it. What happens if you break through the ice? Yep, every year, people break through the ice. I am not pretending this is a totally safe activity whatsoever. But if you break through the ice, generally, you don't have to worry about the vehicle just plunging through the ice water and taking you down with it. The wheels are going to break through first, and then the frame is going to sit on the ice. But it's going to break through too. You need to get out immediately and then call somebody. And it's going to cost you an enormous amount of money because they have a daily fine for every day you don't get the vehicle out of the pond. But it happens often enough that if you call the National Park Service, they know what to do. Just have your wallet ready. So if I haven't scared you off of ice driving, Voyageurs National Park in Minnesota is a place where you can do it. And it's generally later in the winter. Obviously, it takes time for this thing to freeze over. So not a December activity, more of a February activity. So you've got time. The website is nps.gov/voya, V-O-Y-A. Isn't that a commercial? Voya. Oh, that's something else. Anyway, yes, go there and do it. Or don't. You don't have to. Resource recommendation. This is an anti-resource recommendation. I may have talked about this before, but, and I'm sure you've heard of this. Anyway, it's called Honey. Honey is this little thing you put in your web browser, and it offers you coupon codes when you check out anywhere on Amazon or anywhere you buy stuff. It'll say, hey, I've got 15% off here. Click here, whatever. Okay. I've used Honey. It has saved me $150 over, say, the course of 15, 20 years, which is not nothing, all right? So because I installed this thing, I got $150. Didn't cost me anything. So why wouldn't I recommend this? Well, because they're sneaky. First off, we knew that what Honey was doing was that, well, let's back up a step here. Remember, I just told you about this Amazon Basics heater, right? And there's a link in the show notes. Well, that link goes to Amazon, and my affiliate code is embedded in that link. So if you buy that product from Amazon, I will get a tiny portion of the sale, which helps support the podcast. Doesn't cost you anything. You don't even know it's happened, but I get a little bit from that. And that's why people are always pushing Amazon stuff, because they get affiliate links. If you'll look in my show notes, you'll see I have a little notice at the bottom about how that happens. You should just assume that. Not all of my links are affiliate links, and I don't distinguish between them, but I do enough of them that I just might as well pretend they all are. They certainly are if they're from Amazon. So the idea here with Honey was that Honey's going to jump in and say, hey, I have a coupon here. And if you accept the coupon, it will then replace that affiliate code with Honey's. So that's how Honey makes money. They give you a 10% coupon code that they collected from somewhere, and then they get that little portion of the sale, and me, the person who directed you there in the first place, gets nothing. And you might think, well, that's not fair, and I might agree, but at least Honey was providing a service in that case. You know, they were giving you a coupon, they deserve something for that. Lots of arguments to be had there. But that's not all they're doing. Basically, Honey is hijacking everything they possibly can all the time. If you click on the coupon and it doesn't work, Honey gets the credit. If you don't click on the coupon, Honey gets the credit. They just steal every affiliate code that they possibly can, meaning that by using Honey, you're screwing all the creators out there, whether they're on YouTube or podcast or whatever, anybody using an affiliate link. Will you save money? You might, except there's another level to this that's even more evil. If you are a company, like let's say you're Joe's Widgets, okay, and you offer a 30% coupon for first-time buyers at joeswidgets.com, you can contract with Honey, pay Honey, so that if people use Honey on your site, they only get a 15% coupon code. Because most of the people using Honey don't hunt for coupon codes. They think Honey's doing it for them. But Honey's actually hurting you because they are forcing you to have a lesser code than you might have found on your own, sometimes even just by looking on the company's websites. So Honey is not your friend. I mean, sure, I made $150 in 15 years, and I didn't really have to do any work for it. But their business model is such that it hurts everyone. It hurts the consumers because they're not getting the coupon codes that they should. It hurts the businesses because they have to pay Honey to restrict these coupon codes. And it hurts all creators because everything they're doing is now being hijacked by Honey in regards to affiliate codes. So, all that said, the choice is yours. If you want a little service that sits on your web browser and will offer you coupon codes, check out Honey. All you have to do is Google Honey. I'm not going to give you a link. That's all you have to do. But if you're somebody who actually wants to promote independent creators on YouTube and podcasts, I'm talking about everybody here. This doesn't affect me all that much, but there are definitely people out there it affects a lot. If you want to support that, I would recommend you do not use Honey. For me, I deleted it all. I deep deleted it. I made sure there's no bit of Honey left on anything I have. So, choice is yours. Just want to make you aware of it. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 241 of Built to Go. Happy New Year to everyone. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. And if you need to get a hold of me for any reason, I am Jeff at builttogo.com. That's two T's, not three, not one. And until next time, remember the words of Jefferson Payne, who said, "The road teaches patience, the van teaches simplicity, and the journey teaches gratitude. Fill your tank with all three."